Hey everybody, this is Tom Salemi of Device Talks. Welcome back to the Device Talks weekly podcast. Boiler up, everybody. I got my Purdue sweatshirt on, got the hat on. We'll be watching the Final Four this weekend. Looking forward to that. In addition to that excitement, we have lots of excitement on the MedTech side. Lots of great news, of course. J&J and Shockwave. J&J offering $13 billion for Shockwave, which is something that has been, of course, kicked around for the last couple of weeks, and Shockwave's been targeted by one suitor or the other for the past year. We also had the interesting Karl Storz in Asensus news, which would bring a new surgical robotics player into the market. So to cover both of those big news items, brought back Joe Mullings. Joe, a.k.a. Jostradamus Mullings, which is a nickname I coined for him because he called some of this when we talked last year. You've heard some of that. Some of the talk about the potential for M&A and surgical robotics on this podcast and on our video interviews. So it's coming. It's here. Things are real. I wrote about it for Medical Design and Outsourcing this week. Some of the five things that are really going to make 2024 look like a seminal year for surgical robotics. And it's happening. And we'll be talking about it at Device Talks Boston. We will have, of course, Distal Motion. I just spoke with CEO Greg Roach this morning. We'll have him in a future podcast. We'll have Intuitive. We'll have CMR Surgical. We'll have Quantum Surgical. We'll have Stryker. And, of course, Medtronic is going to be delivering our closing keynote, showing off some of the power and potential of Hugo. So there's a lot of conversations that'll be going on at Device Talks Boston, which will really, I think, center around this week. Like, what's this mean? Again, I'll talk with Joe Mullings about that. That'll be the first segment. Chris Newmarker's off today, so it was just Joe and I one-on-one. And then after that, I'll share with you a really interesting conversation I had with folks at Savato. Savato is a company that is trying to build an infrastructure for remote surgical surgery, a network upon which surgical robotics can operate effectively or be operated effectively by surgeons located offsite. So I interviewed Dr. Yulong Wang, who's the chairman and co-founder, and Cynthia Perazzo. And Dr. Wang, of course, was the founder of Computer Motion, which is really the first surgical robotics company, even before Intuitive. Ultimately would merge with Intuitive in 2003, and we'll talk about that just a little bit. And then he went on to found or create InTouch, which would be sold off to Teladoc. So he was ahead of the game in surgical robotics, ahead of the game in telemedicine. So I think I'm kind of trusting his instincts on this one, that there'll be a need for a network like Savato, and we'll get into that with him and with Cynthia Perazzo. So this is sort of a surgical robotics-focused episode. A few of them coming up this month will be, but there's just so much going on. And again, we'll be talking about a lot of that at Device Talks Boston, in addition to other things too. We'll have, for example, Scott Nelson of Fastwave and Sean Gilligan of Amplitude Vascular at Device Talks Boston. I booked them a couple of months ago. I joked on LinkedIn that I knew that the Shockwave deal was happening, and that's why I did it. I obviously did not. I'm just fascinated with the space. Talked with these two gentlemen before on the podcast, and we'll get them together at a single table in a single room, talk about their companies, their approaches, what that means, how they're going to be sort of moving forward once the Shockwaves settle. I don't know if that works. But we'll just be covering a lot of territory at Device Talks Boston. We'll have over 100 speakers when all is said and done. We've got registrations pouring in now. It promises to be a MedTechapalooza. So I really do hope you'll join us there. Go to devicetalks.com or really boston.devicetalks.com and register. And you can use the code DTWeekly25 to save 25%. It's a real reasonable rate for all that you're going to get. We're going to have dozens of hours of conversation, hours of networking, and you'll just be able to meet the greatest people. So I hope you'll join us at Boston, Device Talks Boston on May 1st and 2nd. I'm tired, folks. We've been cranking out on the agenda. We've been cranking out on emails, trying to get this conference stuff is a lot of work, so my mind's a little mushy, and I'm excited about the Final Four. We get the Boilermakers. So I hope you'll join us at Device Talks Boston. Again, it's May 1st and May 2nd. Go to boston.devicetalks.com to register. Use the code DTWeekly25 to save 25% off the registration fee. We'll have another Device Talks Tuesdays coming up with you on Tuesday from our friends at AcuityMD. So check that out. Other than that, let's get this this podcast episode started. Once again, Chris Neumarker is off this week. So we'll open up with the interview with Joe Mullings, and then we'll talk with Dr. Yulin Wong and Cynthia Perazzo of Savato. All right, you ready for this?
Ready.
To be back in the Dragonfly 160 studios with Joe Mullings of the Mullings Group. Joe, we keep coming to you for expert advice on all this big breaking news, and it's been quite a week. How you doing, man?
I'm doing well, thanks. And I always appreciate chatting with your audience. And I told you, Tom, we talked about it mid last year. MedTech's going to heat up, man. Here it goes. Between, you know, what we'll talk about today with J&J, I mean, with Storz and Ascensus, but how about Shockwave? Today, $13 billion, another drop in the bucket on top of $16 billion on top of Laminar. J&J is not messing around, boy. They're throwing it down to Medtronic, Edwards, Boston Sci. They are not kidding.
All right, let's start with the Ascensus news. I mean, this is again. You Joe Stradamus strikes again. We talked about this last year. That we'd start to see some M&A, and still, I have to admit, it came as a bit of a surprise. For those who don't follow surgical robotics as closely as you do, I think it'd be helpful to just give folks an update on an intro to Ascensus.
So I'll get the dates approximate. So Ascensus was formerly known as Transenterix, which originally started, I think, in 2006. And Todd Pope, who is really, you know, an industry, in my opinion, mover now, you know, Cordis J&J, now at Revival Healthcare. And, you know, behind companies like Distal Motion right now. But Todd had brought them out. And in 2014 or 15, they ended up buying a platform, Italian-based platform. I think it was for about $100 million or so. And, you know, they changed their name. Anthony Fernando went over there a few years ago. Anthony's a brilliant leader. And, you know, he had to deal with the Senhance platform, which is what it was known as with Transenterix and now Ascensus. And here's the key. It's the only other cleared large format soft tissue robot in the United States, beside Intuitive. Right?
Right.
So that alone is worth entry. So that's number one. But you can't have a surgical robotic platform, a large format surgical robotic platform that's publicly traded. The markets will punish you, because it takes entirely too long, and the path to profitability is way too far down range if you can reach it at all. So you're always going to get destroyed. And I think before this news came out, we were talking about 33 cents on a stock that at one point traded $80.
Wow. Okay.
So you got a bunch of past investors pissed, or even people who bought in a dollar a year ago, really upset that they think this is a game.
And I'm looking at it now, and it's 26 cents, which I don't know how that is, but we don't need to get into stock price talk because...
Yeah, that's not my area of expertise.
Not mine either, but J&J's paying more than that, so you'd think it'd be going up.
Storz is paying about a 66% premium. Sorry to mix you up.
Well, Joe, I know you've been following the Ascensus story for a long time, and you've done some work with the company as well. And you've always been a real strong advocate for what Ascensus is up to, and made a really good argument for their strengths. Explain now today, what is Ascensus bringing to this deal, and what kind of changes or technologies or systems can it bring to the surgical robotics?
Yeah, so, you know, first and foremost, they got a cleared large format robot with the FDA. That's really important. And then the Luna platform that's drafting up behind that will probably slide in through the FDA on that same 510 pathway. So that's really important. When you still have Medtronic, that could be years off, and J&J even more years off, and CMR years off. So I like that. Secondly is the ISU system they got. The ISU, the Intelligent Surgical Unit, right? This is real-time advisement in surgery using video that is going to allow the surgeon to have real-time advisement, as they call it. It's a feature set that no-fly zones, identify hazards, prevent instruments from encroaching on anatomical areas. So that is a very important factor here, because Storz is bringing a best-in-class 3D, 4K stack to the environment. So let's come back to that in a second. Ascensus also is a relatively lean team. There's about 240 people in the company. You have the MST component that came out of Israel that really is the AI ML with Modi Frimmer and his team that developed this ISU that originally Storz partnered last February with Ascensus to market and sell this adjacent to their visualization platform. And Storz also at that point in time was going to help with the end effector development with Ascensus. So you suddenly had this relationship forming there, and they've been hanging around robotics, soft tissue robotics, as I said, from the Medtronic days, 2015 and on. So you've got an organization like Ascensus that's publicly traded, strapped for cash.
Mm-hmm.
You've got a privately held company like Storz who has cash. If you have a tower today in the med tech industry, you eventually have to get a robot. Intuitive made that very clear. In the D5, that tower they released has got the ability to replace the current towers in the surgical environment in the OR. That's really scary if you're a scope company and you don't have a robot, because now I believe they're going to make that agnostic enough and eventually be able to plug other visualization systems in that with their own ISU built into that. This is where the Storz relationship starts to make a lot more sense. So let me pause there and see if you have any other questions.
Yeah, so with the previous work that the Storz and Ascensus were doing, were we headed down this path anyway, or do you think this is a direct response to the D5?
Oh, I think they were. No, this has been in the, and this has been in the talks for a long time. This has been talks independent of what D5 was doing. But what's interesting now is Ascensus was never a distraction to Intuitive. I think this potential relationship makes the Storz Ascensus relationship a distraction now to Intuitive. And if it's not Storz, because Storz decides to back out, which they might, it's now set a market price of a cheap $95 million value for J&J to step in and get themselves a soft tissue robot with a visualization platform, at least the ISU, that then they can go out and start to potentially acquire a platform, because both Medtronic and J&J have begged Storz over the years, privately held company, if you're ever going to sell it, we want to sit at the table. We're interested in buying it. The dynamics happening right now, Tom, are crazy.
Interesting. So if let's assume the deal goes through, how does this new Storz look and compete in this market?
Well, here's where Storz has to be really careful. You know, Storz right now has, I think it's 12,000 towers installed in the U.S. alone. They're installing about 500 towers a year, the rate. To put that up against Stryker, Stryker does about 1,000 towers a year.
Okay.
Right? So that's an important data set right there. What Storz has to be really careful of is what every other non-robotic company has to be careful of, is know who you are. And Storz can get pulled into the deep end of the pool like J&J and Medtronic did. And they got pulled into the deep end of the surgical robotic pool to the tune of billions, and still no product on the market. Storz doesn't have billions to play with.
Mm-hmm.
They've probably got 100 or 200 million cash to play with, and at best probably have 200 to 400 million on a line of credit. And in a company that is about a 6-7% growth rate per year right now, and already over the last year or two has been in some cost-cutting behavior. So they've got to be really careful on how they move forward on their spend technologically, and then they're going to have to reimagine what their go-to-market sales team is like. That takes a while as well. I went out go ahead.
Is this a domino that you think, and I know we have limited time, is this a domino that are we going to see other larger companies now look to other smaller companies, and perhaps more deals like these are likely, because we're seeing a lot of smaller companies making clinical and regulatory progress.
Well, there's not another scope company out there that matches up against with the install base of Storz and has, you know, I think it's the 1788 the Stryker has, the 3K4D, and then, of course, the Rubina platform, the 4K3D. Those are two platinum standards that are the best visualization system. Every surgeon told you, give me a half a robot, but get me a better visualization system. All the AI, ML, and all of the real-time advisement comes off your visualization system. The robot just gets told what to do. I mean, I don't mean to be very basic, but AI on a robot by itself is less valuable than a high fidelity visualization system, and having an ISU on the back of that, which is what Asensus has, that starts to become a breakaway technology, even independent of a robotic platform. So that's why this is really, really important, that if this goes through and there's a discipline at Storz, and they've got a robotic division there, but that robotic division is not the robotic division that you and I know to call a robotic division that is being run at like an Intuitive, right? That robotic division has got to have to find its place and check its ego at the door and let Anthony Fernando, and then they've got to lock up Anthony Fernando and his team to make sure they don't go anywhere. Because if you lose them, then you're going to have a problem, and you just bought something that, again, still needs a lot of cooking on the R&D side. So the whole thing's fascinated. Stryker now has got to accelerate things on potentially looking at robot. This may pull distal motion in. It may pull moon in. So I think a Stryker is going to start looking at a distal and or a moon. They have to. It also wouldn't be surprised if J&J doesn't come to the table as well on the Storz deal, trying to throw elbows in there, or if it doesn't go through. For God's sake, they just spent $13 billion today and $16 billion. You know, this is tip money for them at $100 million. So this, Tom, sets up your device talks the first week of May beautifully. Like I think this is a PR move by you and the device talks team.
Absolutely. No, we timed it perfectly. I've been in collusion with all of these very senior leaders in medtech to make sure it all is coming to head right now.
And one final thing I want to throw out there. One final thing.
Yes.
I don't know if the Storz family is this strategic, respectfully. So if this $95 million deal comes down, you just dramatically increase the market value of Storz at large than it was before this deal. And now what you've got is you've got a sort of later in life leadership team on the ownership side. Is a very tight ownership. I think there's three primary stakeholders of Storz proper. And hey, I don't know. This is me guessing. This could be an exit strategy on an IPO or a straight out sale to the tune of another $16 to $20 billion for Stryker now with that 510K robot packed into a visualization system for a swan song for the family to say, here's our gift to medtech, health tech, and patients. You use it now.
That's a great take. Real quick, I know you got to go. We've referenced Shockwave a couple of times. Where do we go from here if the deal goes through J&J, and one would expect it would? I mean, we've got a couple of other smaller companies out there, Fastwave and AVS. We'll have them both at Device Talks Boston. We've had interested suitors in Shockwave for last year or so, three or four companies rumored to buy them. So is this a space that we're going to see a lot more, you think, M&A and a lot more heat over the coming couple of years?
On your show a couple months ago, I said they are not stopping at Abiomed for big billion-dollar deals, if you remember. And that's an anchor. Abiomed was an anchor on one end because heart failure, you're graduating people to heart failure with other heart disease that you're treating. ultimately they kind of get graduated, whether it's a valve replacement repair or anything in the coronary that you're repairing, it generally is going to lead to heart failure patient. So I think J&J is just revving it up and they're putting their foot on the throat of others in this space, and it's going to force the hand of BSC. It's going to force the hand of Medtronic and certainly Edwards, because they all, as I mentioned today, they have a war room, and every single strategic says, if this company gets acquired, what are we going to do about that category? If this company gets acquired, what are we going to do? And I think this is going to be a catalyst to other deals in that category by strategics right now.
All right. Great stuff. As always, Joe Mullings, thanks for making some time to join us on the podcast.
You got it, my man. I'll see you at Device Talks, May 1, May 2, Boston, 2024. I'm saving you the oxygen. Be there.
Thanks for the help.
See you, buddy.
Take care. Well, Cynthia Perazzo and Yulin Wong, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Thanks.
So I'm excited to learn about Savato Health and how it fits into the ecosystem of connected health and remote surgery and all that needs to happen in healthcare. And we'll get into all of that in a moment. But let's start a bit with your backgrounds. Yulin, let's start with you. You were early on in surgical robotics with computer motion, early on, in the early 90s. Tell us about how you came to be inspired to, is it safe to say you, if you didn't start the field, you came pretty close. How would you identify? You look like a humble individual, so I don't think you'll take credit that that's not due to you, but how would you say?
Well, thanks for the question. I started computer motion in 1990.
Wow.
And then computer motion, I think it is actually reasonable to say that it did receive the first FDA clearance on a commercial surgical robot called ESOP. And that happened in 1993. And then computer motion did go public in 97. And then it merged with Intuitive Surgical in 2003.
Okay.
So that was my background in surgical robots.
I want to track that merger in a moment, but what led you in the mid to late 80s say, you know, what would be a great idea? Surgical robots. How did that come together?
Yeah, the way it happened is, so I'm in undergrad through 82 and then started grad school. And if you remember, the IBM PC came out in 81. So that's kind of the time frame of when the personal computer revolution started. And I was thinking, as I was going into graduate school, what's next after the PC revolution? And I said, it's got to be robots. And so so it was as simple as a calculation as that. You got the computer become more and more of a brain. Now, how do you interact with the physical world? With robots. And then so I did my PhD in robotics. And then in starting computer motion, I can't honestly say I was smart enough to go right for surgical robots, but just because of a succession of pivotal conversations and meeting various people, I ended up vectoring into surgical robots. If you remember, it was in about 1991, 1990, when the first laparoscopic cholecystectomy took place in the U.S., I think late 90s in Europe. And that was the beginning of this whole minimally invasive revolution. And so robots could now be inserted between the surgeon and the patient because you had a layer of technology via minimally invasive surgery. And that's how surgical robots came into play.
Starting off with robotics as an emerging field, I guess I would see warehousing or something that's less life or death being sort of the first application for robotic technology. What possibly veered or pivoted to lead you to wanting to insert yourself between in that tiny gap between surgeon and patient?
Well, the calculus was, you're right, that robots had really kind of become pretty mainstream in manufacturing, but if you remember in the late 80s, early 90s, healthcare costs were still going out of control and growing much faster than the inflation rate. And actually, in the late 80s, the Cold War had just ended. And so even robots in the manufacturing area were kind of on a downward trajectory just because of that whole area was not doing very well. And healthcare costs being highlighted as being so expensive, I kind of had the very high level calculus of, robots, they help improve quality and lower costs. Hmm. So maybe it could apply into healthcare. And then just fortuitously, I got into understanding what was going on in surgery, mm-hmm. which brings us to minimally invasive surgery, which actually does surgical robots. So I can't really take a lot of credit for saying way back in the 80s, I knew this was going to happen in the 90s. It's really kind of just following a pathway, which led to this career of surgical robots.
Wow. I'm sure you endured a lot of blank stares from people as you tried to explain what you were up to. I want to get back into the computer motion store in a moment, but Cynthia, you're coming into healthcare from a different direction. How did you find your way into the healthcare industry?
Well, I grew up the child of two physicians. Ah. So I spent my summers working in my mother's family practice office before electronic health records, before HIPAA. It was a wonderful time. My father was a pulmonologist, so I knew I wasn't going to be a doctor, but I was always intrigued.
Why is that?
Well, so when I was growing up, managed care was making its entry into the Texas healthcare market. And I remember my father saying, it's hard to, we're doing a lot less medicine and a lot more business now.
Wow. Okay.
So I went to UT and got a finance degree and on to HBS and got a MBA. So
you took his advice well. How did you find your way back into the healthcare industry? Was it Premier that was your first kind of step back?
Well, actually, when I was in business school, there was one course on healthcare at HBS at the time. It was Regina Hirschlinger's Consumer Directed Health at that time. And this was before we had sequenced the human genome, and that, really made healthcare big business at the business schools. But so in one class, I thought it was really interesting and did a project for that class and for one other class based on some of the work my dad was doing at the University of Texas in San Antonio. He was building one of the first hospitalist groups and thinking about how to create a managed care group of physicians to take the Medicaid contracts from the state of Texas at that time. So kind of got interested in that and really looked for an opportunity out of business school for healthcare. And had a classmate called me and said, we're doing this thing called electronic health records. I think this is going to be big. You should come work with us. So I joined a startup out of the Boston area that was building electronic health records that were intended to emulate how the physician practiced. So they were handheld Fujitsu tablets replicating over wireless databases. It was crazy. And our first customers were these big IPAs out in the California market. So I spent a couple years doing that before the year of the EMR at HIMSS in 2008.
Wow. So you're both coming in through some revolutionary technologies, surgical robotics and electronic medical records. You both have been through some battles, I'm sure. Yulon, let's focus back on computer motion for a moment. Then I want to get into Savato. But you mentioned it went public in 97, when back then you could go as a medical device company, even one without revenue, you could go public. And it was a very hot sector at the time. The merger with Intuitive in 2003, how did that come about? And it's interesting just because Intuitive is just sort of seen as sort of the founder of the industry, sort of the obviously it's the oldest company. It's the biggest company. I think some people forget the computer motion chapter before that. How did you come to join or have computer motion merge with Intuitive? And how do you feel about the history books of surgical robotics? Do you feel like computer motion is forgotten a little bit?
Well, the winner gets to write history. that's what happened. I think that, computer motion started in 1990. Intuitive started in 95.
Okay.
So those are facts in terms of... The reason the two merged was because we got into an intellectual property battle, which was significant. And the only way to resolve it was through the merger, where computer motion ended up with a third and Intuitive ended up with two thirds. So at that, if you go back to 2003, I was pretty emotionally distraught over the whole thing. There's a lot of, ups and downs through those couple of years. But now the people at Intuitive have done an incredible and an amazing job building the robotic surgery industry. And many of them, are some of my very good friends. And even some of them came from computer motion. Mm-hmm. And I would say that it was really quite a successful merger.
Interesting. All right. Let's talk a bit about today, about Savato. Well, there was this little company called InTouch that you're also involved with that I think is also relevant to today. So maybe we should just focus on that for just 30 seconds, maybe a little longer. How did you come then to move from the conclusion of Computer Motion's story, or at least the chapter that went into Intuitive's book, to creating InTouch? And talk a bit about InTouch. It merged with Teladoc in 2020. So once again, it's kind of one of these almost sector-creating companies, I guess, remote healthcare.
Yeah, and thanks for asking. The way it all played out was before Computer Motion became part of Intuitive is actually on September 7th, 2001.
Oh, okay.
While at Computer Motion, I led a project where Professor Jacques Moresco, who's a very famous French surgeon, he sat in New York City and he took the gallbladder out of a patient who was in Strasbourg, France.
Wow.
So that was done in September 7th, 2001. To get that procedure to happen, Professor Moresco needed to connect with the president of France, President Chirac at the time, who contacted the CEO of France Telecom. And then we had to go to the commissioner of the FDA to allow this surgery to take place.
Wow.
Because it was, you know, on a real human. And so that procedure, it's called the Lindbergh operation. It was the world's first telesurgery procedure. It was also probably one of the most expensive procedures that's ever taken place in the world. So then Computer Motion becomes part of Intuitive Surgical, but that stuck in my mind, which then made me think about just telemedicine, because I hadn't really thought or understood what telemedicine was until then. In 2003, which is when Computer Motion became part of Intuitive, that was before the world was ready or capable of doing telesurgery, but it was telemedicine seemed highly possible, where telemedicine is just bringing expertise, clinical expertise, to a patient wherever they are over the internet, which in 2003 was a pretty novel idea to use the internet to create connections between patients and clinicians from a distance. And that's what InTouch did. And so InTouch, you know, for 20 years, it was really one of the forerunners of telemedicine or telehealth. And that's what Teladoc bought in 2020. At that point in time, we were probably the largest telemedicine technology company, at least in the US, if not around the world, connecting several thousand hospitals. So my background, that surgical robots plus the telemedicine, allowed kind of a very natural segue into what Cynthia and I are now doing in telesurgery, which is really putting those two things together.
Mm-hmm. Let's focus a bit on telehealth, because it seems as if this is the perfect example of, I think in any other industry, if you introduce a technology that saves time and saves money and makes things more convenient, it's adopted quickly because the market demands it. That doesn't happen in healthcare and didn't really. It happened to a certain extent before COVID. I think COVID certainly accelerated a lot. Cynthia, you've worked at hospitals and for healthcare systems. Talk a bit about the resistance, if you would, or at least why these things take so long to find their way into the healthcare system.
It's the ongoing challenge. You know, when I was working in the health system, you know, when we would try to adopt new technologies, typically those that get success start in a pocket and solve an important problem for someone in the health system, whether it's a physician or administrator. In the adoption of telemedicine, we saw most success early on with the EICU movement and telestroke. And one of the main drivers for these to be adopted is the scarcity and lack of access. So in the EICU adoptions, you see the lack of intensivists to cover. And as it became understood that that's best practice, all the health systems wanted to figure out, how do I get intensivists to cover my ICUs? With stroke, which Yulin knows very well, people can get behind that time is brain, and that not having access quickly to that expertise causes bad outcomes. So those are pretty significant problems to be solved. I think incentives are always often at the heart of the ability to drive adoption, even when people like something, if the incentives aren't lined up, you meet resistance. So as we think about some of the adoption of telemedicine, I'm a believer that telemedicine should take cost out of the system, but we have to structurally change. Unless you're closing clinics and taking resources offline, you're not reducing the total cost of care. So you have to keep reimbursements high. So we need to be thinking about incentives, reimbursement, and payment models as we think about innovation broadly in healthcare.
Interesting. So Let's focus now then on what you're up to today, Savato and telesurgery. Hearing about the Lindbergh procedure in 2001, I kind of was immediately drawn to the Seinfeld comment of like, where are the flying cars? Like, where this was 23 years ago, you would think that in two decades plus, this would be somewhat commonplace, and yet it's still something I think it's presented with very much the same level of wonder as that likely was, maybe to a slightly lesser degree, but it's something that we're still working toward. What have the challenges been toward that adoption? I have to imagine it's mostly been technical and technology versus economic, but maybe there's a mixture of both, Yulon. What's happened over the last 20 years?
What's happened over the last 23 years, and Cynthia and I did a lot of work on this before actually forming Savato to convince ourselves that the timing was right, is there are four trend lines which have moved forward sufficiently that we believe remote surgery is now a commercially viable enterprise as opposed to before when it has been. The four are, one is the advancement of virtual care. In fact, the pandemic is actually one of the things that's helped, is helped really drive virtual care into the public's awareness so that now people fully appreciate that you can get high quality care being remote. And so that's one. A second is the advancement of the telecommunications industry. I mean, today, 23 years later, the Lindbergh operation used a dedicated ATM line, which is a type of high bandwidth communication line that had 15 engineers monitoring it on the entire, for the whole procedure. Mm-hmm. Today, you can get 5.9, as in 5.9 reliability fiber optics from almost, you know, any large area to any other large area, and even a lot of rural areas for, you know, hundreds to thousands of dollars a month. It's very affordable now, and it's quite ubiquitous. A third one is the policy and regulatory environment. And this was also helped by COVID, where you can cross state lines, you cross international lines, you can get reimbursed for doing work where the patient is not where you are. And then the last one is the advancement of robotic surgery. And robotic surgery is about to enter a new golden age where many different companies are bringing to fore different robotic surgical capabilities for different types of procedures, covering all the gamut of interventional, surgical, or even diagnostic procedures. And those are tools which allow you to do it remotely. So those are the advancements which have taken place.
And Cynthia, how about the demand? I imagine that's greater as well. I mean, we're learning more and more about health inequity and rural disparities and the lack of healthcare in places that aren't major metropolitan areas. And you don't have to go too far out to run into some of those deserts. Does that add to the demand as well?
Absolutely. I would say the lack of access to high quality surgery. In the United States, there are a third of the U.S. counties don't have a single surgeon.
Wow.
The increased specialization of surgeons, you know, your ability to find someone who does a high volume in the types of cases that you need in your hometown is limited, unless you live in an LA, a San Francisco, New York. And so access, you know, the lack of access is really creating this opportunity. Not only is it an opportunity for patients to get access to higher quality care, it's a real opportunity for surgeons and health systems as well. And this is why we think this next wave of care is going to be so revolutionary. So for administrators who, you know, can't necessarily recruit the types of physicians they want to have programs in each community to serve their populations, they now have an opportunity to export centers of excellence to community hospitals from major centers and really create growth. You know, there's not a lot of growth stories in healthcare right now for healthcare administrators. So they get excited about it. And surgeons get excited about it because it allows them more ORs to operate in a given mm-hmm. time period and increase productivity and do the things that they really like. It's not going to be business as usual to set up a remote surgery program, but the forces and the problems that do get solved for patients, health systems, and surgeons, and then ultimately payers are pretty compelling.
Okay. Great. Well, that, I think, lays out where we are. So let's talk a bit about Savato and your solution. What is it that you're providing? Because you don't have your own surgical, your website says remote robotic surgery, but you don't have your own surgical system. It seems as if you're agnostic as to the system. What is it that you're adding to the solution?
Well, when we set about to say, how do we make this a reality? And how do we take advantage of all of the innovation in robotic surgery? What we found to be missing was a player to manage the ecosystem and really create the new surgical journey. So at Savata, we're focused on the entire surgical journey from referral and patient selection all the way through recovery at home, because the surgical outcome is not necessarily dictated solely by the surgical event itself. You really have to have all the ingredients to make a surgical outcome. So we've focused from the beginning on the entire journey, which means we really need to think about the ecosystem. So really, we're doing three things to create an ecosystem that supports remote surgery. One is we're supporting the robots to cut the cord, essentially. So we're creating a technology that enables surgical robot controls and video images to transport across a network, a curated network that we're developing with low latency, low jitter, high bandwidth, cybersecurity, high reliability. So this, you know, cutting the cord is, you know, the first step in making sure that we can use these amazing robots to care for patients anywhere. The second is we are creating an orchestration platform that enables the surgeon and the care team to communicate, collaborate from referral through the surgical event, all the telepresence needs, the data sharing, the data capture, et cetera, will be managed by this orchestration platform. And then finally, we're working on setting standards and creating incentives and playbooks, anything from training and credentialing to how do you think about approaching payers? Because we really think this business model is an important structural change that will have to happen as we're creating this new ecosystem for remote surgery.
Yulin, could you talk a bit about the first part, the technology, the network that you're sort of building that these other robotics or these robotic surgery systems can operate upon? I don't know tech very well. I barely know what 5G is. What are we talking about here?
Well, one thing is it's interesting. There's a lot of hoopla out there about using 5G for kind of that, which we completely disagree with. You can't use 5G because you cannot get the high reliability, the allocated bandwidth, the security, et cetera, that you need to be able to have for remote surgery. And so we're building something which we're calling the Savato Network, which we believe is it's a low latency, curated, as Cynthia said, fiber optic network, which goes around at least the US, and we're looking at other geographies as well, and can minimize the latency as we travel thousands of miles. And then the various hospitals will need on-ramps and off-ramps off our network. The robotic devices are basically components which go onto our network and then take information off it. As Cynthia mentioned, you know, there's really just three types of signals which we got to deal with. We got to deal with the imaging signals, we got to deal with the robot control for signals, and we got to deal with the status signals. And these signals we have to propagate across that network very effectively. And we've done a lot of studies to show that we're able to do that. The other significant part of the technology are the components which allow these signals to get onto and off the network. So we call these our connectivity adapters or Savato adapters to be able to get onto and off of the Savato network. And then we do have a cloud-based platform, which Cynthia mentioned, which is basically, it's an orchestration platform which resides in the cloud, which allows people and care teams from whichever locations to orchestrate the care journey of a patient from, you know, referral all the way to postoperative follow-up. Those are the principal technologies. And then one final one is a data platform, which allows us to capture all of the data around not only the imagery, the kinematics, the control signals, the status, et cetera, into a data platform, which we can mine and use for all types of applications, like being able to provide feedback back into a quality of surgery in order to provide feedback back to hospitals and health systems in terms of how well their programs are going and things like that.
So focusing on the first part, the fiber optic, is this your own cable that you'd be laying down yourself?
It is not our own cable.
Okay. No, continue then, because I was going to get into the whole VIOS thing, but please answer my question and I won't throw random thoughts at you.
And the fortunate thing is around the world, you know, there's plenty of dark fiber out there, and there's also fiber, which is being used, which is not used to capacity. And the telco's willing to work with us in order to, as we match, and we can actually cross telco boundaries at these data centers and get reliability commitments or SLAs as we do that, so that the Savato network, which is a Savato-owned network and curated, but the underlying fiber owners are the telcos. But the customers will work with us, as in the hospitals and health systems will work with Savato to get onto and off of that network, as opposed, they don't need to contact any telcos.
So Cynthia, if you're working from an existing fiber optic network, how far out do those go? Are you able to reach those remote, those rural hospitals that were, or areas that we've been talking about before, or are you sort of just sort of building on a network that's already somewhat, it's not limited, but it doesn't go everywhere?
It goes a lot further than most people think.
Okay.
We have actually done a study of every hospital in the United States, and we've been able to identify that over 95% of hospitals have fiber running into them already. The other 4%, we don't know because there's not data out there, but there's been a lot of investment in fiber through government programs at the state and federal level that have really accelerated the adoption of high bandwidth that's primarily fiber.
Oh, interesting. Okay. Well, how about the data part? I mean, that's something that a lot of companies, surgical robotic companies, are collecting on their own, and I think they want to keep it because the data is valuable to them. Is that something that you would collect in addition to what they're collecting for themselves? Are you sharing their data? Are they sharing their data because they're on your network? How would that play out?
The architecture that we are building has the data platform in the middle of the Savato network. So data is flowing across the network and can just, in an ambient way, be recorded into our data platform. Now, obviously, we're going to need to work on contracts with the health systems and the robotic companies about the usage of that data. But Savato will be in a very exciting place to be able to have a data platform, which is in the right in the middle of all the action. It just happens by virtue of splitting the robotic surgical system apart.
And where we are is across the entire surgical journey, where surgical robot is just during the surgical event itself. So we're sitting in an expansive longitudinal place. And not only will we be able to collect data, but by the nature of our platform, we'll be able to serve up information, decision support, feedback, et cetera, leveraging the data we're collecting and potentially data that others can introduce into our system.
Where does your path to success start? Are you selling first to a majority of hospitals who then surgical robotics companies must work with you to service? Are you working with the surgical robotic companies first that hospitals wanted to use them must work with you? Are you going the payer route? And maybe to get paid, they have to work with you. What's the surest path to success in your eyes?
Well, we view the customer as the hospital, health system, and surgeons. It's because ultimately their reimbursement pays for robots and platforms like Savato. And we're working with a number of health systems and surgeons on building the platform to solve the problems that they have around access and increasing productivity, et cetera. And we're building our platform such that the robotics companies could plug in. So we're partnering with many robotics companies right now. What we found in our conversations, you know, at one point we thought, maybe they're already building this and we'll put the network and the orchestration platform and they'll plug in. And what we found was that most robot companies are busy with FDA approvals and building the next instrumentation set or, you know, expanding to another procedure. Their to-do lists are very long, particularly the emerging ones have other things they need to be doing. So thinking about how to enable this network connectivity, we've found they're very interested in having a player like Savato in the mix to do that for them in a way that is sort of standard across the industry. And the health systems want standards too. The health systems want to have one network provider that any robot they choose to use can plug into, because it's, you know, a pretty significant infrastructure coming in and out of the health system.
No, that makes sense for sure. So are you the highway that any robotic system can get off and on, or do you have a gate for only those that are your partners and only some can get on and some can get off, or some can get on? I'm sure you'd let them off if they wanted to get off.
The goal is to be an open platform that any robotic company that meets the standards, there will be standards for safety and participation, and we're in the process of developing those standards today.
And Yulin, where are we with the technology? I feel like someone who might have been talking to you in 1990 or probably less with telehealth, because that made more sense. But I'm listening. I'm saying this makes sense. But geez, it seems like I wasn't aware that there's a there yet. You're making a good case for there being a there. Do you have all the pieces you need, all the technology you need, everything you need to sort of assemble this? Or is this something that's going to need further technological development to get to where you need it to go?
There will certainly need technological development, but there won't need to be the invention of anything new which doesn't exist.
Right. So
this is definitely something technologically doable today with good, solid engineering. And, you know, the team at Zivato is somewhat unique in the sense that there's strong experience in telemedicine and robotic surgery, which is kind of what this puts together. But the other thing which maybe I can add, and you hinted at it, is the readiness of the marketplace. And I can tell you, the beginning of robotic surgery, people were like, huh, you're going to have a robot operating on me? And then in the beginning of telemedicine, people said, I don't know if I'm comfortable with them far away. It's funny, both Cynthia and I, you know, just talk to people walking down the street, because it's our day job. We're talking about this all the time. And people, I kid you not, people will say, oh, I thought that was happening already. I mean, so the significant barrier that both Computer Motion and InTouch needed to go through in terms of the cultural shift, I don't think is going to be required here, at least at the way that InTouch and Computer Motion had to deal with.
And final question for you, Cynthia, just Zivato, the company. And from my extensive internet searches, I see you raised a seed round, I think, late last year, and maybe you've gotten some more funding this year. Where are you? How big of a company are you? Are you doing things remotely? Are you working with primarily with contractors and outsiders, or are you looking to be a bigger company? And where are you with financing and with sort of preparing to pay the bills in the future?
Well, we're grateful that we were able to not only raise a seed round in 2022, but we were able to close a Series A with some significant partners.
Okay.
We've been working with Polaris Partners from the very beginning, from the ideation stages, and that's been really exciting. And they are really helping us push this vision forward with financial resources and bringing others to the table. We do have employees. We have an office in Goleta, which is Santa Barbara County. We're growing and looking to keep expanding and get this platform into the market as soon as possible.
Great. And final quick question for you, Yulin. This must be fun to kind of circle back to surgical robotics again. Or is it?
It's super fun. It's super exciting to be putting together the surgical robotics and telemedicine backgrounds that I've spent decades learning about. And it's such a big part of healthcare, right? Bringing surgical access, high quality surgical access to everyone and to everyone around the world. You know, we're all kind of very excited about that mission too.
Yeah, I think we've all wondered how these hospitals were going to be able to handle so many different types of surgical robotic systems that they can't, you know, you don't even like to, I won't change from my Mac because I'm just so used to the ecosystem. I can't imagine buying anything Droid or PC or otherwise. So I'm sure having a neutral system like yours will be very well received.
We agree.
Great. This has been a great conversation. Thanks for joining us and for telling us about Zivato. I appreciate the time.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us.
All right, well, that is a wrap, folks. Thanks again for joining us on this episode of the Device Talks Weekly Podcast. Once again, I can't implore enough, please join us at Device Talks Boston. It's going to be a great time, and I don't want you to miss it. Go to boston.devicetalks.com to register. Use the code DTWeekly25, and you will not regret it. Don't forget, Device Talks Tuesdays is happening on Tuesday. Check that out at devicetalks.com. While you're there, check out all of our podcasts. And, of course, we're available in every podcast player. Make sure you subscribe to the Device Talks Podcast Network so you don't miss any future podcasts. I'll actually be taking a little trip next week to record one of our new podcasts. So looking forward to that. Maybe I'll have some photos up on LinkedIn to spill the beans. DT Weekly 25, save 25% off the price of Device Talks Boston, which is happening on May 1st and May 2nd at the Boston Convention and Exhibition Center. Connect with me on LinkedIn, connect with Chris on LinkedIn. Seriously, please do. It'd be great to be part of your med tech conversation. So that again is a wrap. Thanks so much for joining us. Tune in next week. We'll have another couple of podcasts for you. I believe we have a Stryker Talk coming out. Woo-woo. And Device Talks Weekly at the end of the week. Take care, everybody. Boiler up. Go Boilermakers.